It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says Madison needs to do more to help Milwaukee flourish.
First, the United States maintains hundreds of military bases and other military facilities around the world. By many estimates, around 800, not counting active war zones. The idea is to have a local military presence to respond to crises and to protect the interests of the United States and its allies. But our next guest says these installations do more harm than good for American security and diplomacy.
David Vine joins us now. He's an associate professor of anthropology at American University. His new book is called Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we threw out a number there, but the question of how many bases can be tough to answer depending on what we're talking about. Can you give us an idea of the range of different installations the U.S. has around the world, from full-on bases to smaller outposts?
It can be hard to figure out. The Pentagon puts together a list of its bases around the world every year, and by the last tally, there were 686 bases outside the 50 states in Washington, D.C., but the Pentagon list actually excludes some well-known bases, and that's where I get to the 800 number. But you're right, there's quite a range between really city-sized bases that are full of schools and hospitals and housing and family members with tens of thousands of troops, to much smaller bases, including increasingly popular kind of bases called lily pad bases. These are popping up in parts of the world where the United States has not had a military presence ever, in parts of Africa, Central and Eastern Europe. And they typically have on the order of 200, 300 troops, often special operations forces, sometimes drones, surveillance aircraft, that hopefully gives you a sense of the range, as you said.
And to put this into context, how does the number of American foreign bases compare with those of other countries?
Yeah, I think that's important. I think most people in the United States, I was certainly one of them before I came to this story 14 years ago, most people in the United States have no idea that the United States likely has more bases, foreign bases, than any people or empire or nation in world history. Currently, the rest of the world combined has about 30 bases, 30 foreign bases, that is, among them. And Russia, Britain, and France have most of them, and a few other nations have a single base outside their own territory.
A lot of people might have thought, okay, the Cold War ended, a few decades ago now, and then we were going to maybe start closing up shop at a lot of our bases around the world. What happened?
That's exactly right. Most of these bases date to World War II, actually, and the early days of the Cold War. So they've been there for 70 years or more. We did close a large number of bases at the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s, downsized by about 60%. But we still maintain this base network that's basically about half the size of what it was at the end of the Cold War, because we've continued to build new bases, especially in places like the Persian Gulf, where we have a very large base infrastructure now in every Persian Gulf nation except for Iran. And actually, the total number of bases has shrunk from about 1,600 at the end of the Cold War to 800 now. We're in twice the number of countries, so the breadth of this base nation, as I describe it, has increased from occupying 40 nations in 1989 to about 80 nations today.
A lot of your book focuses on the idea that the presence of these bases ultimately may do more harm than good when it comes to security, America's reputation, diplomacy. For one point, do bases having foreign troops parked on your soil lead to anti-American sentiment in a lot of countries?
They do, in the book I try to show how these bases, while we've been told frequently that they spread democracy and ensure peace, those claims have just not been challenged. And I'm encouraged to say that there are people across the political spectrum who are now beginning to challenge and question the need for these bases, beginning with the costs. But the bases indeed do inspire quite vehement protest and opposition often. There's a range of relationships in Germany and Italy. There have often been very cordial relations between locals and troops. But even there, we've been seeing increasing opposition and protest in recent years, as well as in places like Okinawa, where there have been a very large protest movement since really horrific rape took place in 1995 as part of a much larger pattern of crimes and accidents that sadly U.S. military personnel have committed.
The entry point into this story for you was in the dislocation of local peoples, sometimes the entire population of islands, sometimes farmers near a base in South Korea, I think, people being removed from their homes. How common has that been in establishing or expanding American military bases?
Displacement has been another of the clear patterns, that is, local people being displaced as part of the creation or expansion of U.S. bases overseas. And indeed, that's how I came to have my eyes opened about this huge network of bases around the world when I was introduced to the story of Diego Garcia, a very small island in the middle of the Indian Ocean where the U.S. military has a very large and significant base. The only reason we have that base there is because in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the U.S. and British governments forcibly removed the entire local population and deported them 1,200 miles away, just dumped them in exile where they had no resettlement assistance. And the people have been living in exile ever since, struggling to get back to their homeland. And as you pointed out, they are far from alone. People know of the Bikini Islands where there was nuclear testing, but there are other examples, including in Okinawa and Guam, where people were displaced well after World War II. And Okinawa, some of the people were displaced as far away as Bolivia.
We're talking to David Vine about his new book. It's called Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the United States needs hundreds of military outposts around the world to guarantee our security, or do you think we have too many? If you've been deployed to one of these bases or worked on them as a private contractor, what's your perspective? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with David Vine, author of the book Base Nation. He says that the hundreds of American military bases around the world aren't really boosting our security.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with our guest that we have too many military outposts around the world, that they aren't needed for American security? Or do you want to make a case that the U.S. needs a military presence in potential trouble spots around the globe? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And David, the value people say of these bases, they might deter aggression in one place. They offer the United States an opportunity to respond to a crisis in a trouble spot, whether military or humanitarian. Don't these bases provide some kind of value when it comes to our security?
Well, there are a couple things to say about that. First, there are alternatives to this, what I see as really an outdated military strategy. Given technological developments and the power of the U.S. military, the military can actually deploy its troops, its forces, from the United States to locations abroad just as fast or almost as fast as from any overseas base. So the strategic value of having troops permanently positioned overseas really is declined dramatically. And the extra costs, which are very substantial, bases overseas are much more expensive than domestic bases, really doesn't justify any marginal speed increase that you get by keeping forces and bases overseas. And when it comes to the deterrence argument, I think it's worth people in the United States thinking about how we would feel with a foreign base anywhere near the borders of the United States. For example, a Chinese base or a Russian base in the Caribbean or Central America or Mexico. I think that would lead to hue and cry for boosting U.S. military spending and generally to increase military tension. So, you know, while one base can be described as defensive and a deterrent presence by one power, you know, China, which is encircled by U.S. bases, sees these bases as entirely aggressive, and our presence has only encouraged China, my sense is, to increase its military spending and military power.
So would you say then that bases, it sounds like, are inspiring a kind of arms race and maybe could lead to more likely conflict in a situation like that?
Yeah, that's one of the real dangers I see, that the bases often increase military tensions, regional military tensions, and encourage, as you said, an arms race and actually make war more likely. There's a danger of a self-fulfilling prophecy here where there are calls for the U.S. to build up its military presence even further, even though we've had hundreds in East Asia. We've had hundreds of bases there for decades. There are calls to build up that presence to counteract the growing military power of China. My fear is that is actually going to make war more likely as China builds up its forces, the U.S. builds up its forces, and the possibility of a really horrific conflict become more likely.
I want to dig more into the idea of the lily pad concept that you mentioned earlier. The wave of the future, it doesn't sound like, is the really big, sprawling complex that we used to see, especially during the Cold War. But with the lily pad, you had conversations with some people in the military who, very circular conversations where they wouldn't call them a base or a military presence even of the United States. So how do these things work?
One of the reasons that lily pads have become increasingly popular is because the hope is that they will prevent the kind of protest and opposition we've seen in places like Okinawa. They are generally secretive in nature. Often they're located within a host nation base. And as you mentioned, the U.S. military personnel and diplomatic officials are frequently very... they very much do not want to refer to these bases as bases, that when in fact, in my mind, they very much are. There are a series of linguistic games that often get played. For example, actually, a long-standing base in Honduras has been called a temporary base for almost three decades now. And with lily pads, you see something similar, linguistic and legal efforts to disguise their presence. And in my mind, you know, while these bases may seem preferable to the giant bases that cost far more, first of all, these bases are putting U.S. troops in parts of the world and in conflicts that we know very little about frequently, in Africa, for example. And there's also a clear pattern that once a base is established, they tend to grow. They tend to, whether there's a need for them to be there or not. So there's a danger that a base initially portrayed as quite limited in size could become a much more significant base and a much more significant U.S. military presence over time.
You also point out that an American military presence of whatever sort can be a target. It can create the risk of targeting of American personnel by anti-American forces.
That's exactly right, and that's what we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, of course. But more broadly in the Middle East, we've seen that the presence of U.S. bases and troops has actually led to increased radicalization. So bases have been directly counterproductive. There's a correlation between the presence of U.S. bases and troops in the Middle East and al-Qaeda recruitment. So these bases, which were, again, designed for World War II and the Cold War, in the case of the dangers and threats facing the United States today, are really... counterproductive frequently, and as I mentioned before, also a tremendous waste of resources that could be dedicated to addressing the very many needs at home.
So you're making the case here in your book. Do you see leaders, political leaders in Washington starting to embrace this rethinking of the need for bases?
Slowly. You do see members of Congress beginning to rein in some of the really out-of-control military construction spending overseas. There was very little oversight and very little questioning when the Pentagon would come and ask for money to build new bases or expand bases. Members of Congress really didn't ask many questions. But in the last few years, there's some encouraging developments that have constrained the amount of spending. But still, we are, by my estimate, and a very conservative estimate, spending on the order of $85 billion a year keeping bases and troops overseas. And that doesn't even count the cost of bases and troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we still have bases and troops. And so if you include that, the total rises to around $156 billion. And again, that's a conservative estimate, so the real cost could be even higher. And I think it's, again, worth thinking about all the needs, infrastructure needs, school needs, needs in terms of our healthcare, our housing, that have gone unaddressed while we've built up this very significant, robust base infrastructure overseas.
That was the political level. Briefly, do you see any military rethinking on these bases?
I do, and this is another really encouraging sign. Their members of the military are also questioning this decades-old policy of maintaining so many bases and troops overseas. So you see the Air Force attempting to cut the number of bases abroad, and similar efforts in other services. So there are voices beginning to question the status quo, and again they really are across the political spectrum and within the military itself. So I think there are good opportunities to close bases that are simply unnecessary. And my argument is not that tomorrow we should close all our bases overseas. Instead, the argument of Base Nation is that we should be looking carefully at every single base overseas and ensuring that it is absolutely necessary to maintain there.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Vine. His new book is Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest tells a tale of two cities and the economic disparities between them, Madison and Milwaukee.
In a recent column for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, Tom Hefty says Milwaukee is the state's largest city and historically an economic driver, but Madison has prospered much more since World War II. Among the reasons, he says Madison has gotten an unfair share of state resources in terms of government jobs, university spending, and economic investment.
Tom Hefty is a retired CEO of Wisconsin Blue Cross. He's chaired commissions for both Republican and Democratic governors. His piece for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute is titled How Madison Democrats Stole Milwaukee's Prosperity. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first, Tom, paint us a picture. How big is the economic gap between Madison and Milwaukee?
In terms of job growth, Madison has in recent years consistently doubled the job growth of Milwaukee. And Milwaukee has been below the statewide average, a unique fact in the Midwest. Every other major Midwestern city has stronger growth than the statewide average. Milwaukee drags Wisconsin down.
Well, let's get into the points you're making in your piece now as to why that is. One of the reasons, a big gap in state government employment. Tell us about that.
Well, Madison is the state capital, and there are a number of state capitals that are not in the major cities. But historically, in other states, the state government jobs are more equally divided. Madison has the second highest percentage of government jobs in the country among major cities. Milwaukee's among the lowest, and that difference is thousands of jobs.
And why is it that way? You point toward Milwaukee, Madison, both being strong Democratic cities when it comes to voting behavior. Why do you see Madison getting a disproportionate number of state jobs?
Madison Democrats have been far more aggressive and effective at winning state jobs and winning state building projects. The new project on the west side of Madison is reported to be the largest state office building constructed in state history.
And let's turn toward another similar venue, higher education, UW-Madison, UW-Milwaukee. How do you see the state's investment in those two differing?
Well, again, it differs when you compare it to other states. The spending per student at UW-Madison is actually very close to the University of Illinois or the University of Iowa, a football game tomorrow. And it's roughly $19,000 per student per year. UWM is two-thirds of that, $12,000 per student.
And how does UWM compare to, say, other big city branches of those other universities?
again, significantly lower. I use the comparison to the University of Illinois Chicago, which actually receives more per student than does the Big Ten University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
UW-Madison is known as a research institution, gets a lot of grants, things like that, that aren't part of the state budget. Is that something we need to take into account when we look at that disparity?
I broke out those two spending areas, the total research spending and the education spending, in my article. And yes, Madison is a world-class research institution, and everyone should be proud of that. But the underinvestment in the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is significant, and it's one of the factors dragging down the Milwaukee economy.
And then a third factor you point to in your piece is promoting new technology and startups. And again, there you say the state has done more for Madison and Dane County than for Milwaukee and Milwaukee County.
Yes, Wisconsin has improved in venture capital, but it needs further improvement. We're sort of in the middle of the states nationally. The reason for that goes back to Act 255 in the Doyle administration, which has tax credits for venture and angel investment. But the recent report from the state shows that two-thirds of the companies receiving state funding, state venture funding, are in the Madison area, over twice the number in the much larger Milwaukee area. So again, Madison wins, Milwaukee loses.
Is that just a matter, though, that maybe a startup wants to be near the big research institution in the state?
Those two go together, and I think all three items are actionable: location of state employees, budget for UW-Milwaukee, and venture capital allocation. And they do go together, but there is no reason that Milwaukee doesn't receive a more equal share, similar to Chicago, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, other major cities in the Midwest.
Isn't there a part to be played by the idea of Milwaukee sharing a fate common to a lot of Midwestern industrial cities, industrial decline, Rust Belt status, white flight? Aren't those part of the picture that are maybe outside of these state spending factors you're talking about?
They're all part of the conventional wisdom, but the conventional wisdom is wrong. Other Midwestern cities have made the conversion to stronger economic growth. As I indicated, if you look at the recent data, the quarterly data, the monthly data, Milwaukee is lagging not only Wisconsin growth, but it's lagging other metro areas. And that's due to the factors that I mentioned in the article.
We see pretty good economic times generally in places like Ozaukee and Waukesha counties, the suburban counties, if you will, around Milwaukee. What's leading them to do well compared to Milwaukee? They are not Democratic strongholds.
Well, the 21st century has been described as a metro century in terms of job growth. Much of that is in the service sector. Many of those jobs are in suburban areas. But that is true in Chicago, Minneapolis, Indianapolis, and Milwaukee. And so you have to dig down to the differences by industry. And what you find is venture capital, university technology spending, and state government employment are major factors. And if you look at the detail in the article, there are many statistics. But I include both City of Milwaukee and Milwaukee metro area comparisons, which include those suburban areas. And the Milwaukee metro area also lags the other metro areas in the Midwest.
So what would you like to see change, whether under a Republican administration as we have now or perhaps a future Democratic administration? What would need to change to give a little more love to the Milwaukee area?
Well, I think the first step is put a major state agency into Milwaukee. It produces jobs, and many of the recipients of state benefits are in Milwaukee. And so the first step would be to do that. Second would be to allocate funds more equally and target specific areas for the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW-Milwaukee. They shouldn't be duplicating each other or competing. They should be specializing. And then with regard to venture capital, it starts with opening service offices, venture investing offices in Milwaukee. Almost all of the state activities on venture capital are in Madison. And the venture capital accessibility in Madison is much stronger. And many small Milwaukee businesses either don't know about those resources or they decide it's not worth going to Madison because Madison doesn't care about Milwaukee.
There have been a lot of political leaders from Milwaukee. Tom Barrett, mayor, ran for governor a couple times. There are prominent Democrats in the legislature. Have they been making a strong enough case that this change would need to happen?
Well, I think they haven't been as effective as Madison Democrats. If you look at things like the State Building Commission, long dominated by Madison area interests, I think they have made an effort, but the numbers speak for themselves. Statistics are very stubborn things, and Milwaukee has been the loser, and Madison has been the winner.
Can you make a case to our listeners and policymakers before we let you go that this should be a priority for the state, writing the balance that you're looking for?
Well, there's been much partisan debate about the state job growth numbers, but the reality is if Milwaukee's growth is not stronger, Wisconsin's overall growth will be weak because Milwaukee, again, drags down the Wisconsin growth numbers. And so I think it's in the state's interest, including Madison's, to put resources into helping the Milwaukee economy grow.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tom Hefty. He joined us to look at the reasons behind the economic disparities between Milwaukee and Madison, and he shared his ideas of how to change them.